Okay, let's go ahead and open up the Chronological Study Bible to page 78. Raise your hand, please, if you do not have a copy of the Chronological Bible. We've got a whole stack over here to let you have. Everybody's got a copy, looks like. Okay, so we ended up last week there in Matthew chapter 12, and just going to pick up this morning at the bottom of that page with Matthew 12, verse 38, which, of course, you then can instantly see is information found only in the Gospel of Matthew. So God led him to reveal, starting in verse 38 of verse 12, chapter 12, some of the scribes and Pharisees answered Jesus, saying, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, and yet no sign shall be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so shall the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh shall stand up with this generation at the judgment and shall condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah. And behold, something greater than Jonah is here. The queen of the south shall rise up with this generation at the judgment and shall condemn it, because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Now when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places, seeking rest, and does not find it. Then it says, 'I will return to my house from which I came.' And when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. This is the way it will also be with this." And what are the two words that end verse 45? Evil generation. How did we start early on in verse 39? He answered and said, "A what generation? Evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign." So you have this section recorded only by Matthew in this 12th chapter, in which Jesus once again, in a manner that really is shocking to us, I think, because of the culture that we live in, and it's a desperate and obsessive desire to pass a judgment of approved on everybody and anything. So when someone like Jesus here stands up, declares right to somebody's face that they are evil and that they are adulterous, and I think it doesn't take anything away when he says an evil and adulterous generation. The whole point is they have asked him specifically to do something for them. They want to see a miracle. He specifically answers them and says, "I am not going to show you a miracle." And that under this rubric of an evil and adulterous generation craving a sign. And so there's no mistake in anybody's mind. There's certainly no doubt in ours that as Jesus stands there, not 3 to 6 feet probably away from the people that have just asked this question, he is saying to them, "You are evil, you are adulterous, you are the generation that I'm talking about. You are not going to get a sign from me right now, you know, on demand, but there will be a sign that will come, and it's like the one in Jonah's day. And in Jonah's day, those people did what you won't do." I think he's subtly saying to them, "This is why I won't give you a sign. Jonah repented, sign or no, you wouldn't. The queen of the south shall rise up to judgment because she paid her respects to Solomon. She was responsive to that truth. You guys are not." There's another way that he is indicting them and criticizing them very directly. And then when he gets to 43 through 45, and he is saying to these people now with this illustration that they are like people freed from a demon, and now they're in worse shape than when they started. This brethren is just so forceful. It is so, what we say, in your face. It is so courageous, and it is so right and proper on occasion, even for us today. There really just is no doubt that we are the people who are supposed to be doing the work of the Lord in this day.
I have to tell you, I had a very interesting conversation with my brother. Maybe I should blank out the tape right here. But I'm kidding. He doesn't listen to the tape, but I have more than one brother, so for those of you, I won't tell you which one it is. But anyway, I had a conversation with my brother on the phone, and he was explaining to me why it was okay to swear, why profanity is not such a big thing. Well, he's never been a Christian, he grew up in the world. If I did, I would become a Christian. He never did. And so for the first time ever, really, I got up in his face. Let me explain to you something. And he was trying to argue that, well, because everybody does it and, we all have come to accept it, then it's not such a big deal. In fact, he said, and this is an argument my kids used to give me when they were young, why, I don't even notice it. I haven't heard it anymore. And so I tore into my brother yesterday. I tore into my kids, and I just said, look, that's the problem. When you allow yourself to be desensitized to these things, when you allow yourself not to rise up and oppose these things, when you allow yourself to just lay down and be trampled on by, these things, then you are accepting it. And you are taking your first step down that road that results in not being offended, not being upset, not even hearing it. So I explained to my kids many years ago that your argument is that it's okay because you don't even notice it. What you're saying to me is the worst possible thing. You're saying to me that you've switched off your conscious decision-making mind. You're no longer evaluating. You're not choosing to decide whether a thing is evil or good. And that's the worst possible thing that you can do. You want to be ever alert. So I explained to my brother in rather florid language, as a matter of fact, none of it profane, but very clear, that just because people do certain things and they're not offended by it, does not make it right. So I named a number of things that, immediately he would be upset about and wouldn't want to just tolerate, but people do all the time. And they do it, doesn't make it right, and just lying down for it makes it worse until eventually you are caught up in it and don't even notice. Is that what Jesus is doing here? No. So, when they come and they say, "Teacher, we want to see a sign from you," what's he been doing for months all over Israel? Working miracles. They've had no lack of opportunity already. So he knows that they're asking for something that they just would not respond to, do not deserve, it isn't honest. And he answered and said, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, yet no sign will be given but the sign of Jonah the prophet." So Jesus rises up, as I did with my brother, to just try and explain, we need to wake up to what is right, what is wrong, and be taught and be teaching what is right and what is wrong. Now, I'm not going to spend any time this morning on the great 3 days and three nights question. People have struggled with this for the longest time. There is a brief section in the back of this book dealing with chronologies on Jesus. Those essays back there, it doesn't directly go into it, but at least just mentions it. I think the most likely solution to this is either we are incorrect on the day of the week that we think Jesus was crucified and would be spending time in the grave. Or it's a colloquial expression that is therefore not requiring that there be exactly 72 hours, 3 in darkness and 3 in daylight. But I don't want to take the time to give you the pros and cons and wrestle, with the solution to that question. Ultimately, I don't think it matters. Jesus rose from the dead. Now then, the prophecy was 3 days and 3 nights. Every other prophet in the New Testament except the prophecy was fulfilled. In their culture and times, and as eyewitnesses, they never doubted or questioned that this was fulfilled precisely as Jesus said. It's only centuries later that we don't quite understand, I think, their cultural expressions, so it doesn't seem like it's being fulfilled to us. But they were the eyewitnesses, and they were the people that spoke this language. You know, we still got their mic.
And so it ought not to be any in-out. But if you want to get into those particulars, they invented the Internet for just such things. So you can go online and say, how long was Jesus in the grave? And there'll be 45 articles that'll pop up on the first page. And you can just hear to that to your heart's content. Sometime when we're doing more specific, dedicated studies to the Gospel of Matthew, we can slow down and spend some time with it. I've got a number of charts, you know, and I'll give them to you, but not this morning. So, the prophecy was no doubt fulfilled. In verse 41, though, the men of Nineveh shall stand up with this generation, and in 42, the queen of the south, as we know her as the queen of Sheba, shall rise up with this generation at the judgment. Both shall condemn it, both because they responded first to the preaching of Jonah and then to the wisdom of Solomon, and in both cases, something greater is here. When Jesus says something's greater than Jonah here, something's greater than Solomon here, who's he talking about? Himself. Do you think they didn't catch that? I think they caught that. So I don't remember Jonah working any miracles, and I won't say that getting spit out of a fish and surviving is not a miracle, but I don't think he worked it. Okay, so that's a pretty amazing thing, but he did not work it. Solomon, to my knowledge, never worked any miracle, though his wisdom borders on it. You know, there's nothing miraculous about that. Jesus has been working miracles for months, and they come, you know, asking for the show. He's just not going to do it. Your attitude is bad, and it's as bad as 43, 44, and 45. Now, don't you wish you knew more about this? I don't know what that expression, waterless places, means. I can't give you one shred of additional evidence in your Bible about this fact, which Jesus alone, as the Son of God and an eternal spirit being, had insight into. He tells us that this is the case, but it is also not the point of what he is trying to make, not the point he's trying to make. So, you know, I wish I knew more about that. It has fascinated people for 2,000 years now. I can only tell you this absolute, undeniable, irrefutable fact. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, do they want to go out? That you find from all these demon possession places. They don't want to. This is because we now learn that they go to some form of uncomfortable existence, place, that is described as waterless. And apparently, they are seeking rest and can't find it. So whatever it is a torment to them. Therefore, they're trying to escape it, and at this time, when there still were miracles and there still was demon possession, they seek then another host body. So, in 44, he says, I'm going to go back where I came. And finds it unoccupied, swept, put in order, takes seven others with it, worse than himself. They go and live there, last day of that man, worse than the first. And this is the way it'll be with you. You are bad. You are evil. You are an adulterous generation. You seek a sign for the wrong reason, and I'm not going to give it. You are not the people of Nineveh and Jonah's time. You are not like the Queen of Sheba, and you will not get this miracle from me. I will tell you that one day you will see something that will be akin to what happened with Jonah, spending 3 days and three nights in the belly of what is described here as a sea monster. It's called a fish in the book itself. And the Son of Man is going to be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. They would live to see this. It would take place in their generation. They too would be eyewitnesses to this fact. Now, is that a miracle? I should say. So you're even an adulterous generation. You'll get your sign. It'll be a resurrection from the dead. But you, unrepentant, are not going to get today, you know, for me what you're craving. You are like these unclean spirits. You are going to be in worse shape than you're in now, and you're in bad shape now because you're a part of an evil and adulterous generation. Now,
you know, when someone that you really respect dies, this congregation at this particular point in time can relate to this, you know, like no other. They occupy your mind, don't they? You find yourself thinking about them.
Yesterday, I drove all the way up to Seattle, well, the day before, spent the night with my son, went to 11 o'clock memorial and came back from a man, the memorial for a 71-year-old man named Jerry McDonald. How many of you, raise your hand, knew Jerry? Ever heard him preach? Jerry's influence was never very, you know, extensive down here in this state. It was enormous up in Puget Sound area, as well as in California, Tennessee. Jerry preached in a number of places throughout his very long career. How many people have you brought to Christ?
Well, you know, there'll be differing numbers in this room. I asked Jerry how many people did he bring to Christ in his lifetime. I asked him 9 days before he died. He said, Larry, I know for sure with my own hands that I've taught and baptized over 500 people in the 45 years that he was a Christian. I just can't imagine. Just can't imagine. 500. Then he said, however, those cards that you know is the plan of salvation, and I taught here among the very first lessons I ever presented to this congregation, he was publishing for 45 years, I guess, and he said, there's probably another 500 people and maybe 1,000 that have come to Christ through the cards. The people that I taught and baptized, for instance, would be among them using those cards. Significant number of people who taught themselves and went looking for someone to baptize them because they had the cards and nothing else. They read them and looked up the scriptures, found that truth, went looking for that truth. Congregations now exist, whole congregations, because if somebody's getting the cards, reading them themselves, one thing leads to another.
Why do I bring all that up, you know, in this context? Because yet again, I'd like to make this point about the force with which Jesus delivers the message in Matthew 12 in this section. At the memorial yesterday, I was pleased and moved because the preacher there, also a man I've known for more than 40 years, and who described himself as Jerry's best friend, very close to those two, all this last nearly five decades. You know, he was saying that back in Illinois, where he had essentially begun a new group, they did exist, but very small, and thanks to his efforts, they built a new building, you know, and really became something. You know, they described him as the bulldozer. And it just so warmed my heart, because for many years, and not knowing that they were doing that back in Illinois, I had come up with that same illustration. He was a bulldozer. The most astonishing thing you ever saw. It was about next door impossible for him to ever meet a total stranger, anybody, and not bring up the name of his Lord, offer them the opportunity to study, encourage them, and then among the saints, just driving the saints far beyond. You think I'd ever push him? Can't imagine. Jerry would go to people's houses, knock on the door to get them out of bed if he suspected they weren't coming to the assembly that morning. How about that? How would you feel if I thought you ought to be at some given meeting and you started missing a couple, so I knocked on your door at 8 o'clock in the morning and said, hey, get out of bed. You need to be in that Bible class. How would you like that? Is this any way to run an airline? Is this any way to build a church? But that was Jerry. That's always been Jerry. How many people have you brought to Christ? How many churches have you worked with? How many, you know, it just goes on and on. And how did he do it? He did it, brethren, by being in your face with everybody that he ever met. He was unstoppable. And you either got out of the way or got mowed down. And I was really moved yesterday, really glad I went, hoping and he is not the last of a dying generation, hoping that he will, you know, inspire others to rise up and just be that evangelistic. I've seen it. You couldn't go to a restaurant. You couldn't have a meal. Everybody at the table was just embarrassed because Jerry is up somewhere trying to get the waiter, the busboy, or the owner to come be with us the next Sunday morning. It's just awesome. What is Jesus doing in 12:38 through 45? He is refusing to roll over. He is refusing to just go along. He is refusing to be polite. He is refusing, you know, to do anything but to say, I'm going to plow this earth, and you will respond however you will respond, but you're going to know that my machine came through here. I'm going to leave a furrow behind me. You know, you get flattened, or you get out of the way, or you jump on board. These are your only choices. So, brother, let's remember, you know, occasions like this. And don't you ever let yourself say, well, yeah, but that was Jesus. He's the Messiah, so really doesn't apply to me. It's just not going to fly. Yes, he's Jesus. He is the Messiah, the Son of the living God. All of that is true. But, you know, I think of the Apostle Paul as being a bulldozer, too. I think of Timothy as being a bulldozer, and Titus as being bulldozers, and I think there were a lot of bulldozers in the first entry, and I just wish there were more today as well. Okay, so then, he sure made his point, and those people understood they'd just been called evil sinners to their faces. Okay, now what are you going to do about it? That's okay, but certainly Jesus did not shun to declare the gospel. Paul did not shun to declare the gospel, nor should we. So we continue in Matthew 12 now. We're over the course of the middle of page 79 now in the left-hand column, for there are three writers who record this event. We'll use Matthew still at verse 46. While he was still speaking to the multitudes, so the venue hasn't changed, behold, his mother and brothers were standing outside seeking to speak to him. Someone said to him, behold, your mother and brothers are standing outside seeking to speak to you. But he answered the one who was telling him, and he said, who is my mother and who are my brothers? Stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, behold, my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father who is in heaven, he is my brother and sister and mother. And so, with a very simple statement, of course, Jesus made a point that we've all easily understood and appreciated for just the longest time. You are born into a family. That family is yours by virtue of the flesh. You have ancestors, and you are going to be producing, you know, as well, most people. And so, this is humanity. We are tied to the people that come before us and the people that come after us in this immediate progression of life entering into the world. That's just a fact. But there's also a spiritual family. That family is of greater significance and more importance. That family, that spiritual family, we are also born into it, born again, rising to walk in newness of life as a result of our being baptized into Christ. But when we do come dripping wet out of that water, we are now a part of the body of Christ, the kingdom of Christ, but also the family. He described himself as being our brother. And so we are a part of that. It is a great and important thing, and more so than the flesh. And Jesus here is actually pointing out at the crowd, made the physical motion to say, this is my family. And in so doing, is ranking those families as well. He doesn't immediately stop and say, oh, hey, the fam is here. You know, so I need to go talk to my mom. My brothers are here. There's no such thing. As I am not going to interrupt what I'm doing here for them. Loves them, appreciates them. They wanted to see him. He wanted to see them. But this is my family. This is my family. And again, the object lesson then that Jesus just offered us there, we need to incorporate and just grab onto that and realize that we should be so much closer spiritually even than we are physically. How blessed you are if you have both. Any comment or question on any of that? pretty straightforward. And as you know, we're trying to move rather rapidly as an overview through this material. So on to Matthew 13. What is Matthew 13 famous for? It is the chapter of parables. Matthew 13 is the great chapter on parables. And in fact, you see in the bold print there, parabolic mysteries about the kingdom. And then you've got the setting of the parables. And section 83 is the parable of the soils. And as you turn pages to 84, it's the parable of the seed spontaneous growth, the parable of the tares, the parable of the mustard seed, the parable of the leavened loaf. And we have this entire chapter that is one parable after another. Properly and very technically translated, what does the word parable translate into from Greek to English? Not the definition. If you translate the Greek word, what does parable mean? I want somebody to respond from my teen and young adult class, preferably. Not too good in here, Lori. They're out there in the teen and young adult class. Out of the room. Okay, what's me?
Well, I'm not a teen, but anyway, dealing with earthly things with a spiritual meaning.
Okay, that is true. That's not the technical definition I was looking for. That's a definition. Perfect definition. What? Yes?
Laying along.
There it is. Saber's back. Feeling not too well, I understand. Good to see her. Bright eyed and bushy tailed, she sure got it. Para means alongside. Bole is the Greek word that means to cast or to throw. Parabole is to throw alongside. So you have some truth, you have some concept, you have some idea that you want to present. In order to present it as clearly and fully as you can, you cast alongside that idea some similar event in life that people are familiar with. They can relate to this for sure, and so then immediately they'll see all these connections. It'll make sense to them. However, in the casting alongside, so as to illustrate and to elucidate some spiritual or other concept that's being presented, does the parable necessarily always just cause the hearer to go, oh, I get it? No. Because quite surprisingly, in some senses, a parabole, this thing that we cast alongside, may be as obscure or more obscure than the point you were trying to make to begin with. And when that's the case, it is set there for the purpose not of revealing and casting light so you can understand. It's now there for the purpose of motivating and stimulating you to either dig deeper on your own or to start asking questions of the teacher. It's there, as I hate the word bait. That's such a negative connotation, but it's there to be a stimulus to provoke you to get more involved. And so we're going to have a whole series of parables here. And the one that is the feature in the chapter, the big long one, he doesn't explain it any more than he does the others, but then the disciples, two parables later, he's given a whole series of them, and then he'll tell one, and then he'll tell two more, and then the disciples will say, what? They don't get it. But he's explained to us, what was that about? See? And then, of course, Jesus is going to reveal a great, a great deal more. He's going to give us a great deal more. And so it becomes very much clear. So let's go rather rapidly through most of these. And if we're fortunate, I think today is my plan, to really try to get through all of this chapter. These are parables, some that are quite short, some that are very clear, and so we'll try to focus on that longer one. Now, we're starting then on page 80 at Matthew 13 and verse 1. We'll use Matthew as our standard, but as you look at these next successive, or the facing page rather, is there a lot of blank space in either of those other columns? Really not a lot. Luke's is the least full in this, but they're all three saying much the same thing. So we're going to stick to Matthew here. And to begin with in verse 1, on that day, so same setting, very busy day, Jesus went out of the house. He was sitting by the sea. Great multitude. What sea would that be? Galilee. And great multitudes, plural multitudes, gathered to him. So he got into a boat, sat down. A whole multitude was standing on the beach. He spoke many things to them in parables. Very pointed day. Jesus had a new teaching technique. He's got everybody's attention here, and there's a whole lot of people to be paying attention. So he starts off, "Behold, the sower went out to sow. And as he sowed, some seeds fell beside the road, and the birds came and ate them up. Others fell upon the rocky places where they did not have much soil, and immediately they sprang up because they had no depth of soil." Next page, top of 83, verse 6. "But when the sun had risen, they were scorched, and because they had no root, they withered away. Others fell among thorns, and the thorns came up and choked them out. Others fell on the good soil and yielded a crop, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. He who has ears, let him hear." Now, with regard to this one, the disciples ask a different kind of a question than we'll see a little bit later. In verse 10, they want to know, why do you speak in parables? So they're not directly asking, what did that mean? They're saying, why did you do that? Now, note, has he done this before? Yeah, it's a way of life with Jesus. So we have a concentrated record in Matthew 13. It's not the first time he's done this. So this has been intriguing them. It's got their attention. And so why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered and said to them in verse 11, "To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted." Now that is really interesting. Because, brethren, if you'll look at verse 10 of Mark 4, it says, "His followers along with what?" So the followers are separated from the 12. In verse 9, in Luke's column, it says, "His what were questioning him." Okay? So don't get the idea that 12 men walked up and said, why? It wasn't those guys. It was disciples and followers as well as those guys. But it's broader than the 12. So, the 12 would be included, I think. They're certainly disciples. But he is not saying, you 12 are in a special category. You guys get special insight. I'm treating you different than everybody. He is not doing that. He's saying, you disciples are in a different category. You, the group of people that includes the 12 and these others, you have insight. To you it has been granted. But not to what? This vast multitudes that are out there. So you've got a huge number of people that are broken down into how many groups? Three groups. The first group, the smallest group, has how many people in it? 12. Then you've got this unknown number. They're disciples. And then you've got what would be, I'm sure, a very much larger number that's everybody else. So who are the disciples? What are the disciples? What does that word mean? Either louder or one of the colors. Follower, okay? One that's devoted like that. Liz, we were wondering what happened to the newcomers. Did you guys have something?
Yeah, Vaughn is coming up. I'm going to the bathroom.
Pardon me?
Vaughn is the bathroom.
Okay, he's coming in now too. I was worried at least maybe something was happening out there. So, okay, they're coming in. All right, a disciple is not somebody that shows up to hear sermons. A disciple is not even somebody who's following Jesus at some personal discomfort, including hunger and heat and distance, you know, to go see what Jesus is doing. The multitudes are doing that.
and are still not yet disciples. So yes, a disciple is a follower. What is the other term that we use? Starts with L.
Learner.
Again, everybody's learning something. But this now is a group of followers and learners that are not in the 12, and they're not in this group, though you could use those terms of everybody. They're separated, and they get a special blessing and insight. So, what is a disciple? I'm asking because you need to ask yourself, am I one of these? A disciple is someone who is devoted to that teacher. A disciple is someone who more than shows up to hear sermons.
Loads of people do that. A disciple is someone who has a commitment, an involvement, a devotion, a degree of following and learning that has transcended what multitudes of people are doing all over Israel. They have distinguished themselves as being the people then who are there, let's say, first, how often? Absolutely as often as they could, apparently. For how long? As long as they possibly can. They're not in the 12, but they're not going home like the multitude is either. And I sure wish I knew how big that group is. But it's that group. Why do you speak? And he said, to you, disciples, it's been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. So if you get into that group, if you devote yourself, will you learn? Will you get what you seek? Yes. Ask, seek, and knock. But verse 12, remainder of 11, but to them it has not been granted. For, now 12, whoever has, to him shall more be given. He shall have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see. While hearing, they do not understand. While hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in their case, as multitudes now, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you'll keep on hearing, but will not understand. You'll keep on seeing. When you turn the page now, you see that Matthew gives the lengthier quote, the much more full passage from Isaiah there. And so, and we are told, in their case, prophecy of Isaiah, so it's being named, is fulfilled. And, turning the page, you'll keep on seeing but will not perceive. The heart of this people has become dull. With their ears they scarcely hear. They have closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their heart, and return. Then I should heal them. So blessed are your eyes, because they see, and your ears, because they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see, and they did not see it, and to hear what you hear, and they did not hear it. Now please note, this is big, I think, a single word in verse 18. Hear then the parable of the sower. Now, brethren, did everybody in these many multitudes hear the parable? Did everybody hear the parable? Yes. Did everybody come and ask, why did you do that? No. And when he says, hear then, after his discussion about who hears and who sees and who understands and who perceives, he says, it's been given to you. Hear then the parable of the sower. Now what does Jesus do, starting in verse 18 down to 23? He explains the parable of the sower. To whom did he explain the parable of the sower? To the disciples that came and asked him, why'd you do that? He tells them why. Qualifying them, classing them, and telling them, you're in a better group. So, hear then. Hear because you're in that group. Now it's been given you to understand, so I'm going to give you to understand. And he does. Starting in verse 19. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what's been sown in his heart. This is the one on whom seed was sown beside the road. One on whom seed was sown on rocky places is the man who hears the word, immediately receives it with joy. Yet he has no firm root in himself, is only temporary, and when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, he immediately falls away. One on whom seed was sown among the thorns is the man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. And the one on whom seed was sown on the good soil, this is the one, hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit and brings forth some 30, some 100-fold, some 60, and some 30. Okay? Who got the understanding? Only the disciples. Okay? Now they know. And now we know because they asked. Why does Jesus speak in parables? Because he's sorting out the ones that want to learn and become disciples from those who don't. Brethren, I don't think Jesus would stand there and say, "You vast multitudes are an evil and adulterous generation." He was reserving that for the sign askers. So now there's four groups of people. But, you know, it's better to come hear Jesus. But if you're not asking, if you're not seeking, if you're not knocking, if you're not really going after it, will you hear and understand? No, you'll be cut out. If you are interested and apply yourself, will you absolutely be guaranteed understanding? Sure, all the disciples get that. And then he added, in Mark's column now, he was saying to them, a lamp is not brought to be put under a peck measure, is it? Or under a bed? Is it not brought to be put on the lampstand? For nothing is hidden except to be revealed, nor has anything been secret, but that it should come to light. If any man has ears to hear, this whole thing is about you guys that can hear and you guys that can't. If any man has ears to hear, let him hear. And he was saying to them, take care what you listen to. By your standard of measure it shall be measured to you, and more shall be given you. For whoever has, to him shall more be given. Whoever does not have, even what he has, shall be taken away from him. That's important information, brethren. Because it is Jesus drawing lines in the sand. You Pharisees, you want these signs? Get out of here, I'm giving you nothing. You multitudes, I'll increase as long as you come. But when are you going to open your eyes? When are you going to open your ears? When are you going to listen? When are you going to become disciples? You disciples, blessed are you. And you're going to gain knowledge and insight along with responsibility. And you 12, we'll be under you. I'm sending you out in all the world. They're going to kill you, every last one of you, with junk.
The multitudes in verse 12, whoever has given shall be given and with abundance, but whoever does not have even that which he has shall be taken away from him. And if you apply that to the multitudes at this point, I mean, he's just telling them that, you know, you think you have this, you think you have me, but it will be gone from you because you're not doing what
you really don't. And I would add one more thing to it, to be taken away. I'm not so sure that would have to do with some overt action on God's part that's going to grab it, you know, and take it from you. So much as what happens to these people? They just are less and less and less involved. They come less and less. And we worry about it as elders and preachers. We see the attendance is going down. They're not doing as well. Seeing less and less. They're learning less and less. They're getting farther and farther away. And what they had is eventually what? It's lost. And then you talk to these people 10, 15, 20 years later, and you just can't believe it. They know nothing. It's just astonishing. I've had that experience. I was a part of a congregation for almost 5 years, and then I moved north 40 miles, and I preached for 27 years. And then I came back and became the preacher where I had been to begin with for those 5 years. When I came back 27 years later,
I was absolutely astonished that now people who are 27 years older and knew nothing, they had done nothing with their lives for 27 years. They were infant babies in Christ. And some were elders. And some were elders' wives. It's just unbelievable how little they knew. Don't let that happen to you.
Class dismissed.